John Clayton.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live at 710sports.com. On demand everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app. Now, John Clayton.
Well, lots of stuff breaking in the sports world as we start to get into games. Baseball season started last night. Mariners get their first game tonight. Then we find out that the Sounders just notified their season ticket holders that they will not be able to they'll be not able to play in the stand. Nobody in the stands for the game starting in August, and so everybody's getting their refunds back as far as the Sounder tickets. So that's not a good sign. We'll see what that means for football as far as fans in the stands, but at least in the Sounders games, there's not going to be anybody there. Buffalo has now taken on Toronto Blue Jays as a new home because it didn't work out in Pittsburgh. But in a lot of ways, you kind of wonder, it's like, hey, why didn't you consider Buffalo first? I know certainly the stadium's not going to be good as Heinz over at the stadium for the Pirates, but what you're looking at is, you know, a smaller minor league type stadium. But again, the big thing is now, at least for the Toronto players, you know, they can be, you know, if they can drive back and forth occasionally to see family if the family's not down there. So a little bit of a better commute. We've got other things going on too as far as what's happening with the NFL, because they're getting closer to getting some kind of a deal on a bunch of stuff. So let's get into the five biggest stories of the day. Top five brought to you by us.
Number one.
Yeah, we want to stick it to the Astros on our own. We don't need anybody to tell us. So I think they're an awesome team. You know, they've been in a really good place over these last 5 years, and obviously last year was a tumultuous one for them. But our focus has to be on what we can do. We can only control our end of the equation. We're young. We do have competitive pitching, in our opinion, and we're going to run competitive pitching out there this weekend. But we know we're playing one of the best teams in the American League right out of the chute.
That's Jerry DePoto talking about the start of the baseball season and his first game against the Astros. Marco Gonzalez will be getting his second opening day start. He goes against Cy Young winner Justin Verlander. And so the key right now, I saw that Fangraph basically said the Mariners should be a 22-38 team, but obviously so much of the success or failure of this year's team is going to be depending on how they do in their 10 games against the Astros. You know, last year they were 1-18, and so now if they can win two or three games, like even just win one game out of the four over this weekend, that would be a good thing. Mariner roster was set yesterday. We got to know the six starters. Little surprise in Bishop being let down to Tacoma. Because I guess they only really have two true outfielders. They need some roster versatility, and of course they wanted to make sure that they had 17 pitchers on the roster, 11 relievers to go with the six starters. And so the two natural outfielders are Malik Smith and Kyle Lewis. That's about it. You even have D. Gordon kind of going between second base and also going in the outfield. So that was kind of roster flexibility, which I guess is going to be needed. Overall, we'll see how the Mariner pitching staff can do against the Astros. We'll also see if there's going to be any retaliatory things for the Mariner pitchers if they try to hit them. We just saw that earlier this week where three Astro batters got hit by pitch, particularly after all the cheating they've done and all the spying and all those different things. So pregame show will begin at 5. First pitch is going to be at 6:10. We're going to talk to Larry Stone of the Seattle Times at 11 o'clock to discuss the start of the Mariner season.
Number 2.
The big issues right now, Jay, and I'm sure this will shock you, are all about money. And the players want to know what the procedure will be if they decide to opt out, or if they have to opt out for medical reasons, what happens to their contracts. And then, of course, there's the big issue of projected 2020 revenue loss and what effect that has on future year salary caps. The owners want to take the hit up front. They want to put as much of those losses as possible into this year and next, and then just start the salary cap growth where it was in 2022. The players want to spread the hit out over a number of years, so they're kind of negotiating from those two poles to meet somewhere in the middle.
the owners have a conference call at 10:30, and there's a couple conference calls scheduled by the Players Association to kind of give the update. And I would imagine that this thing is going to get done because there's no reason. I know that the owners were upset about that tweet storm on Sunday because pretty much on Saturday night they had wrapped up the protocols and got all that done. They just needed the approval of the Players Association. And so they come back and leaked out. It's like, well, if we can't get a deal by Sunday, we may just cancel the season, which, of course, is absolutely ridiculous. You know that's going to happen. Simple thing on the revenue, okay? What you have is, you know, maybe $100 million loss per team if there's not going to be fans in the stands. And, of course, some of that can be made up with creative things and all those different revenue things that they can.
No first-round buys. It'll be just pure seeding, 1 versus 8, 2 versus 7. The advantage to winning the division is all 3 games in each series, then they'll be played at home, all at the site of the club with the higher rank.
So a little bit of a surprise, but maybe a pleasing surprise in the sense that they were able to, with Rob Manfred, get a players agreement with the Major League Players Association that they can expand the playoffs from 10 to 16 games and 16 teams. And every team that's 1 or 2 in the division receives an automatic bye. But in the end, it looks like that should be a fair thing. It makes it players are going to receive bonuses from about a $50 million pool that's going to be distributed around at each part of the postseason. So now it looks like 16 teams can make it. We'll see if the Mariners can be one of those 16s. I know Fangraph has them at about a 22 and 38 team.
Number 4.
1-1 to Stanton. Swing and a high fly ball well struck out towards left center field. That one back there on its way and gone. Absolutely crushed by Giancarlo Stanton out to left center. And just like that, the Yankees jump out. And it is 2-0.
So the Yankees, on a shortened game by rain, were able to beat the Nationals 4-1. Garrett Cole allowed only 1 hit over 5 innings in his Yankee debut. And in the nightcap, the Dodgers blew away the San Francisco Giants 8-1. Kiki Henderson went 4-for-5 with a home run and 5 RBIs. And so now the opening day for starts again today. You got a 1 o'clock start with the Braves and the Mets. And, of course, the Mariners go at 6:10 tonight. So baseball is underway. And the one thing I think you can notice, I'm thinking the ball looks even more juiced than it did last year. A lot of powering home runs. And, you know, I don't know where they're getting the baseballs, but I know they have a lot of them. But more maybe going out of the park.
Number 5.
Here's where Jamal is helping and hurting himself at the same time, because he's clearly trying to make it as uncomfortable as possible for the coaching staff and the front office, and they want to get him out of there. Problem is, if you want to get him out of there, that same coaching staff and front office wants fair value, and to your point, if they sense, someone senses, hey, it's really ugly
we'll
right there.
We'll give you a 5th rounder for them.
Exactly, yeah. Right. They're going to try and lowball you. So I understand why he's doing this to sort of get where he wants to go.
Exactly.
But he may, and by doing that, be shorting his own long-term goal.
So Adam Gase was ripped by Jamal Lewis Adams, who wants to try to see if he can get out of there in a trade. And apparently now he tweeted out a little bit ago that he actually got an understanding is that there's a chance, not before the training camp, but maybe they would consider trading him before the start of the season. But he basically ripped Adam Gase, the head coach, saying he's not a leader. He doesn't really get involved with the players that much as far as telling them. He lets the assistant coaches do that. He also ripped general manager Joe Douglas for saying that he wanted to get a deal done and he's not got an offer yet. But of course, how do you make an offer when you don't even know what the cap's going to be for next year? You know, that would have to happen during training camp. And so Adam was able to say that he's showing the Jets for his teammates and all that stuff, but we'll see if he reports to camp. I know he has a roster bonus 5 days into camp, but this is a messy situation. Seattle is interested because he's such a good player, but then the price, what is the price going to be? Because, you know, you're talking about maybe not just one of the better safeties in the league, but one of the better defensive players in the league, but nothing's going to happen before camp, which of course is going to start on Tuesday. But a messy situation as Jamal continues to kind of go the Jalen Ramsey approach and try to at least rip as many people in an organization as he can to try to get out of there. Hey, you can listen to the show on the 710 Sports app. It's powered by the Dubin Law Group. Coming up next, we're going to talk about Seahawks who are no longer. Who is, other than Jadeveon Clowney, who would be the guys who are going to be missed the most that aren't on a team this year and someplace else this year? Coming up next, and of course, this is the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
Under Further Review with John Clayton.
We'll review the play.
Well, the Seahawks are still waiting for the approval on the protocol for training camp, which is just delayed because of any other reason that they don't have enough players, people in the Players Association to review those 1,000-page documents. And so it looks like, you know, everything's all set for rookies and presumably rookies and the veterans to all show up on Tuesday. But of course, you know, they're sitting there right now over across the wave trying to wait for everything because they just don't know. And they're also waiting for the owners and the Players Association to at least go there. I know that a conference call for the general managers and the coaches are going to begin starting at, and also the owners, in about 14 minutes. So there'll be some updates coming from that. But as everything goes right now, the Seahawks, you know, had very active offseason in the sense they were able to add 10 players and also 8 draft choices. But also they had some losses. And of course, the biggest loss was to Jadeveon Clowney. And it's not a loss yet because he's not agreed to anything. And I think he's holding to a number that nobody's going to match. And so it's going to be wait, wait, wait. So we'll see. But who would then be the next player and the next group of players that are going to be missing? Michael Bumpus talked about that today on Danny and Gallant.
If you can't pick Jadeveon Clowney, what departed Seahawk will be missed the most in 2020?
First, big ups DJ Fluker, met the dude, nice guy, one of the biggest human beings I've ever been close to in my life. It's crazy, I can't believe we're made that big. It's nice to see that he's trimming down. I think you're going to miss a DJ Fluker because he's the muscle, he's the attitude, right? But there's somebody else that I think the Hawks are going to miss the most, and that's Justin Britt. He was the center for the Seattle Seahawks. Only played 8 games last year, but when you lose your center, you lose the captain on that offensive line. You lose the guy who checks out of things, who makes sure that guys are in the right protection. And now we already know what the carousel is like for the Seattle Seahawks when it comes to offensive line. There's always somebody in, somebody out, and that doesn't change this year. But if you can have one constant, you probably want that to be your center, because when you can't make the calls, I'm talking about Russell Wilson, when you can't make the checks, you depend on your center, and you have a great relationship. Now he's got to work with a new guy. He got to work with Finney. Finney's been in the league a bit. He's got some experience, but it's chemistry. It's just like when a quarterback is throwing to a receiver, there's chemistry there. Now, when Russell Wilson can't get in the right protection, he depends on that center to make the calls and communicate with the other 4 guys up there. So we always talk about protecting Russell Wilson, talk about how important he is. He's going to have to adjust again and learn a new center.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that as much as DJ Fluker was such a catalyst on the line, a guy that, you know, brought that punch you in the face mentality and was a big, good run blocker, I think that you know, losing Justin Britt was even bigger, because you know what you're looking at with Britt is it was a good leader. He kept everything in check. He was a talented center. He was a big center. Now I think, you know, BJ Finney can do a good job in his replace, and you know, maybe Ethan Posick could be a consideration in his place. But again, I think that you know, that's the bigger loss, because you hate to lose a leadership. I know when I was talking to different general managers around the league, you know, obviously the left tackle is the most important position, because if you have a right-handed quarterback, the left tackle protects the blind side. But the second biggest guy, and that's why you're seeing centers get $11 million, is you want that guy to keep everything in check on the offensive line, and that's so important. I know, for example, in Buffalo, you know, they were able to pay $11 million to get a center, particularly after they lost one to an injury a couple years ago. And there's a big, I think, you know, the value of centers are very important. So losing a Justin Britt was a big one. Of course, he has the ACL. You know, he's no longer with the team, and no, definitely not coming back at this stage. So I would have to think that Britt was probably one of the bigger losses. The other one, and Fluker would be in that mix, I think, is Quentin Jefferson. You know, Quentin, of course, effectively, right or wrong, was maybe the second best pass rusher on the team last year, because, you know, I know he didn't get the 4 sacks that Rasheem Green had, but he was able to, you know, really put pressure on the quarterback. He rushed well. He really had a good season. I think he was their second most effective pass rusher next to Jadeveon Clowney. But of course, now, you know, that's one of the reasons that, you know, he ends up getting $6.5 million to go to the Buffalo Bills. And, you know, I hated to see him go, because he actually went to my high school. But again, good guy, good player, really did well. And he seemed to play well off of Clowney on the other side when he was a defensive end. Curtis Rogers, who would you vote for as far as big losses on the team, not named Clowney?
I like you mentioning Quentin Jefferson, because I think he gets overlooked in how the Seahawks defensive line stacks up this year compared to the 2019 season. And he did a lot of a lot of good work rushing the passer over his course of his Seahawks career. But I'm going to have to agree with Michael Bumpus and say Justin Britt. Yeah. Remember the transition between Max Unger, who was rock steady for all those years here in Seattle, and then those couple of years where they were just kind of wandering the desert trying to find anybody that would play center. You had, I think, was it Patrick Lewis and Drew Nowak, and those guys were not good at all. And then you see Justin Britt, who was kind of on his last legs here in Seattle. People tend to forget that. He was nearly out the door as maybe a roster cut. They moved him to center as just kind of a last-ditch effort, and he stuck there, and not just stuck, but became a Pro Bowl-type player at center. Going from, you know, a competent center that has tremendous amounts of chemistry with the quarterback to... We don't quite know what B.J. Finney will be. We know he can be good. There was times last year when he filled in for Pouncey in Pittsburgh where he didn't miss a beat, where that offense was still fine. And hopefully that's the case here in Seattle. But the quarterback-center chemistry is one of the most overlooked, you know, important things out on the field. And I imagine Russell Wilson, when Justin Britt was found out to have been released by the Seahawks, can't imagine he was, you know, he was happy to hear that news, because that's his guy. That's, you know, somebody he's been playing most of his career with. And now he's heading into year nine. He's got to figure out a new relationship with a center. That's not going to be easy for anybody out there.
Well, particularly that, you know, getting that relationship when you're not going to be able to get in pads until late August. Now, again, they're still working on the date and, you know, trying to get the three or so changes on the offensive line. That's one of the biggest challenges right now. Fortunately, they have Mike Solari as a coach, and he's really good. And we'll see if he can break a rookie in there at guard. But that's one thing. Yeah, because one, if you're Russell, you want to adjust to how the center snaps the ball back as far as when you're in shotgun, you know, how he adjusts as far as when he's blocking on run and blocking on pass. And of course, you're just not having a preseason game to be able to look and see how that looks. You have to see how he does against the guys on the other side of the ball on your own team. So yeah, that is going to be a tough adjustment.
Yeah, and it's one that the Seahawks really haven't had to worry about since what, 2015, 2016, somewhere around there. Obviously, Joey Hunt came in last year, did his thing, did okay, and there's familiarity there with Russ and Joey Hunt, obviously, because Joey's been in the program for so many years. But, you know, you bring in a guy like B.J. Finney, maybe Ethan Posick gets the starting job. Who knows how the center position's going to wrap, you know, how that's going to work out. I think Finney's probably going to be the leader in the clubhouse right now, but there's still a whole training camp that the Seahawks have to go through in order to figure this one out, and hopefully everything goes well there. John, we talked a little bit about Quentin Jefferson right there earlier on the defensive line, and we all know Clowney, he's not on the roster right now. Who knows if that situation will ever get resolved. But Quentin Jefferson going to Buffalo, his first year away from the Seahawks program. Is there anybody you see on the defense that can fill in for Quentin Jefferson and what he was able to? Obviously, Clowney, we kind of know that production's hard to replicate, but Quentin Jefferson also was effective last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's LJ Collier. I mean, he would be the one that you would look at, because LJ Collier, and again, you can see Rasheem Green too, because the Quentin Jefferson role is that he was a defensive end that can, like a five technique, that can move to defensive tackle when you go nickel. And he was very good at that. So that's the guy that I think that you're looking at to see if he can fill that void. And of course, that's why Collier is such an important part of everything. And then of course, figuring out who is going to be the starting defensive end on the Leo side. But I'd have to think that's why, you know, because honestly, when you looked at how the pressures and everything else, Quentin Jefferson was, you know, not getting the pressures that Clowney got, but he was the next guy. And so, you know, and got rewarded with $6.5 million to go to Buffalo. But, you know, that's, you know, you got to fill in sometimes for what you're going to lose. That's just part of football. Hey, tell your smart speaker to play 710 ESPN Seattle. Remember, you can always listen to 710 on your smart speaker or app. Coming up next, we're going to check in on the Seahawks and see what Brady Henderson has to say from ESPN.com. John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Well, everybody's waiting for guidance right now as far as how things are going to be handled, as far as the cap for next year, as far as, you know, the force majeure, which is the idea is like, okay, guaranteed contracts for veterans after the first game if you're playing. How do you do that? And we got one little update as far as the 80-man roster, because there was a debate, should it be an 80-man roster or an 88-man roster? Players are pushing for 80, which, of course, I thought was a little unusual, because then you'd have to have, you know, mostly 10 guys cut before anybody even sees them. Well, it looks like the compromise is going to be that it's going to be 3 weeks into camp that you make the 80-man roster. And joining us right now is Brady Henderson from ESPN.com. And so, you know, getting a little bit of guidance on that. The owners 2 minutes ago started a conference call with general managers and coaches and the management council to give every update on where things are going. A lot of loose ends, and right now the Seahawks had a chance to have their rookies come in on Tuesday. That didn't happen. They had a chance to get, you know, the quarterbacks and the injured players in on Thursday. That didn't happen. So it looks like Tuesday, once they get the guidance out of this next couple of days, that's when everything will come together.
Yeah, that's what it's looking like. And, you know, I think the sort of soft deadline would have been Tuesday when, you know, a lot of teams were starting to have their rookies show up, but, you know, that can really happen anytime. I think that the real deadline is when training camp actually starts, and this is just another example of something kind of going down to the deadline, and, you know, a lot of times it looks like it's getting so close that it's not going to happen, and now it's looking like there's, you know, they're scheduled to have a call, I think, on the latest reopening proposal today, and so it sure seems like progress is being made, and you know, the roster size one is interesting to me, just because I also found it interesting that players were pushing for 80, just because, you know, that means a handful of guys are going to be out of a job. But maybe the thought is, you know, in a year like this, you know, the bottom of the roster guys are really going to have a hard time making it anyways, and so maybe you're just at that point doing what is inevitable.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, and a lot of these things will be knocked off here in the next day or two, you know, because, for example, I mean, figuring the teams are going to lose about $100 million with no fans in the stands. In fact, I don't know, how do you read the fact that the Sounders, you know, inform their season ticket holders that they will not be having fans in the stands? Do you think that's going to be the same for the Seahawks?
Boy, I really don't know. I mean, it's kind of a tough comparison, just because there's so many more fans for your average Seahawks home game than there are Sounders. I mean, if you just take a step back and look at it like this, the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic and we're talking about, you know, potentially cramming, you know, even half of the normal capacity. So what would that be? 35,000 fans in the stadium. It all kind of, I've said this before, it all kind of sounds crazy to me. So I guess in that respect, it would not surprise me if there are no fans.
Yeah, and that's the thing that, you know, they still have to resolve each individual city. We know that New York is not going to have any of their teams with fans in the stands. And, you know, I thought it was interesting that Buffalo is basically saying the same thing. You know, took on the Toronto Blue Jays, but there's no fans going to be in the stands there. One of the things that you did for ESPN.com is did all the ESPN.com beat people was projecting the roster. So kind of go through the roster and how do you think it's going to go? Is there five wide receivers? Is there seven linebackers? Kind of how you did that.
Yeah, I think I did have five wide receivers and either six or seven linebackers. And the linebackers was, you know, that's kind of in name only, because that includes Bruce Irvin, who, you know, he's going to be rushing the passer on third down. And so I think, you know, in general, my approach to that was, you know, I was really going to give the tie to the veteran players, just because, as I mentioned earlier, you know, this is not a good offseason for a young player, especially an undrafted rookie. But even just young developing players in general, this is not a good year for them to try to make the team, just because you're missing all of those, you know, off-season reps with no on-field work to date, potentially no preseason or at least a certain preseason, and it's just really going to favor the veterans there. So I think, you know, I generally gave the tie to the veteran player. I think I actually had one undrafted rookie making the team. And that was at safety, and that's more about just the position group there. I think that's kind of a spot where you could see some young players squeeze in there, just because I don't think Lano Hill is by any means entrenched on the roster. So But in general, it was definitely favored the veteran players, and I think the offensive line was just the most interesting one because just of all the numbers there, and 17 offensive linemen, and you figure they're probably going to keep around 10. So just the numbers make that, I think, a fascinating position group to watch, and that group has a lot of catch up to do just because continuity is probably more important there than it is in any other group on a football team.
Yeah, no doubt. So any surprises on the offensive line?
Oh, gosh. Let's see. I wish I had it pulled up in front of me. You know, the one interesting one is Joey Hunt, just because he is making a little bit more money, a couple million dollars, on a restricted free agent tender. They brought in B.J. Finney to presumably be their starting center. And you've also got Ethan Posick, who can play center. So that was one. You know, I think Joey Hunt played pretty well for a backup guy stepping into the starting lineup last year. But you know, the combination of the higher salary and the fact that you've got another guy there who can play center, that's an interesting one. And I guess that battle between Ethan Posick and Joey Hunt is one to watch. And then, you know, Chance Wormack is an interesting guy because, you know, normally you would think of a guy with no guaranteed money is very much on the roster bubble, and I think he is, but he can also be their starting right guard, just because, you know, again, Damian Lewis would be the other guy there, but that's a rookie who has not had any reps this past season. So I think the assumption among a lot of people when they drafted Damian Lewis is that he's a plug-and-play starter at right guard. I just don't know, again, with the circumstances of this offseason, if you can really pencil him in right now. So that's another battle right there. But I think even if Chance Wormack does not end up with that starting job, I think you could see him still on the team as a low price backup.
Yeah. What did you do? Did Shaquem Griffin make the team?
I believe he did. Yeah. I think he was one of the seven linebackers I had. And my thought process there was, you know, he's a good special teams player. I think that's why they kept him over Austin Calitro last year, because they felt that Griffin was a better special teams guy, and I'm still intrigued, and I think they are to some degree too, by what he can add as a pass rusher. You saw just some glimpses of it, you know, late in the season last year. I think that the first time was in week 11, so he kind of got a late start. And I think that there is still some pass rushing potential there. And as we all know, as we've all spent the last 4 months talking about, this team could use some pass rushers. So yeah, I had him on the team along with Ben Burke-Urban, and that's a pretty loaded group there. But even with, you know, as top heavy as that group is, it's going to be hard for those bottom of the, you know, roster guys, Ben Burke-Urban and Shaquem Griffin specifically, to make that roster. But I did have him on there in my projection.
How'd you do in the secondary as far as safeties and corners?
Yeah, you know, I mentioned safety being the one position where I have the UDFA making it. And that's Chris Miller, the UDFA from Baylor, who I believe was he got one of the higher signing bonuses of the 17 undrafted free agents that they signed. And I think I had him beating out Lando Hill, who I mentioned, you know, by no means is entrenched in any sort of backup role as he goes into the final year of his contract. And so I had the safeties as Quandre Diggs, Bradley McDougald, Marquise Blair, and Chris Miller. And, you know, the thing I should mention there, too, is I think that, and I've written about this in the past, that, you know, Marquise Blair is battling Bradley McDougald for that starting job at strong safety, and if he wins that, then what happens to McDougald? McDougald has a $5.4 million salary cap charge. I believe the Seahawks would save about $4.1 million of that. So the question is, if he's not their starting safety, does that $5.4 million cap charge become prohibitively high for a backup? I think it could. And so I think Bradley McDougald is, A, you know, fighting for his starting job, and then also fighting for his spot on the roster if he doesn't make it.
Any surprises at outside linebacker?
At outside,
Yeah, does KJ Wright make it?
Yeah, I think he does. I mean, I just go back to the fact that they paid him the $1 million roster bonus in March. So you know, it wouldn't be the first team to cut a guy after paying him a roster bonus. I think the Raiders did it a few years ago with Jordy Nelson. But typically, that's what that bonus is there. Is there for that March roster bonus is there to basically act as a decision maker for the team, where if the guy's, you know, on the team, if they pay him that roster bonus, they're typically not going to cut him later and then end up paying him $1 million for no reason. So I think the question with KJ Wright is whether or not he's going to be ready for week one, just coming off that shoulder surgery. From what I understand, or at least from last I heard a couple weeks ago, you know, the team is not quite certain about that. And so I think either between KJ Wright not being ready or KJ Wright moving over to the strong side, that's why I think Jordan Brooks is going to be starting at weak side linebacker in week one, one way or another.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you can read that at ESPN.com along with all the other teams and their final 53-man roster. Any moves you think Seattle makes? It would be more into camp than I think at before camp. Do you think that, you know, what defensive tackle do you think they go for?
Yeah, that would be the one position. And I think we've talked about this a few times. That's kind of the one position. Once they got their backup quarterback in there, Geno Smith, defensive tackle was the one position I could see them adding to. Just because right now it's basically Jaron Reed, Puna Ford, and Brian Monet, and then a bunch of other younger guys, unproven guys, or the five technique guys that would slide inside in passing situations. So I'm not sure. I'm not really familiar with the list of guys that's still out there, but I think it could be something similar to what you've seen in the past with somebody like Earl Mitchell, who came in kind of late in the game last year, somebody like that, just a veteran guy who's kind of been hanging out there. Just to compete for a roster spot. But I think at this point, it's not going to be anybody that you're going to spend a ton of money on. Certainly not anybody that you're going to guarantee a lot of money to. I think it would just be for depth and to compete for a roster spot.
Okay. Brady Henderson, read him at ESPN.com, and thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks, John. Take care.
Okay. Hey, Brock Huard is bringing his annual football camp to your backyard with Brock Huard's virtual football camp, brought to you by 710 ESPN Seattle, and it's happening the week of July 27th. Parents, here's your chance to sign your kid up for a week-long virtual camp with Brock Huard and former Seahawks Dave Wyman, Michael Bumpus, Paul Moyer, as they lead drills and workouts through a series of videos. Registration is now open at 710sports.com/win, 710sports.com/win. Coming up next, we'll get you updated on what's going on with that owner's conference call today. And what's going on is they try to wrap things up before the start of camp. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to The Professor, John Clayton.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Well, we start off with some good news right now. Russell Wilson and Sierra just had a baby. And, of course, Wynn Harrison Wilson? Is that how it is?
Yeah.
Wynn Harrison Wilson.
Yeah, Wynn, because that's Russell Wilson does is Wynn. And then Harrison, I believe that's a tribute to his late father who passed away some years ago. So, yeah, Wynn Harrison Wilson, born July 23rd. 8 pounds, 1 ounce. And by the look of the picture, it looks like mom and dad and baby are all happy and healthy.
Oh, that's good. And, of course, he's good timing because, technically, he could have had to report yesterday. And I guess in a lot of ways, it was probably fortunate that the league hasn't gotten back to the Seahawks and approved their parameters and what they were going to do in their protocol for camps and all that stuff. And that's only because they're so far behind reading all those documents that you had San Francisco, Detroit, Seattle, and others that are doing it. And, it's like, I guess if you're Seattle, you're at S. And so you're toward the back of the list, not the front of the list. And so you're kind of systematically going through those and, reporting. And like Minnesota's now reporting. So I guess today, or at least yesterday, they were at the M's. And so we'll see how it goes for everybody else. Detroit, the Los Angeles Rams also are coming on Tuesday. So that's still in the air. But in the meantime, trying to get the owners to on their conference call to see what they're saying. I know Chris Mortensen's reporting that the discussion on the 80-man roster is kind of leaning toward the idea that they'll do an 80-man roster, but they're going to do that 3 weeks into camp. And the idea now, which I think is fair, is that, okay, you have all these guys. There's 425 undrafted players who've never been on a football field in the NFL. And so a lot of those guys, all but 33 or 34, have either signing bonuses or they have base guarantees in their contracts. And so it's like, how wrong would it be if, you don't give them a chance? Because what happens then is that if they get cut in an 80-man roster, then they don't get picked up because the rosters are so small. But again, you'd like to be able to see them. And so now you can see that there's going to be the good chance that at least they'd have 3 weeks of work and you can make an evaluation on it. You also have 3 weeks to see where you stand as far as injuries. And so I know yesterday the Philadelphia Eagles let a Well, no, it was the New York Jets, I think, let somebody go. No, in Philadelphia it was, who had a $15,000 signing bonus and also a $22,000 base guarantee. And unless somebody claims him, then, you know, they have to put that on the books, and it counts $27,000 this year and $10,000 next year against their cap. So at least now this is a fair way to do it. And that's what you're seeing. You know, everybody, you know, they may play hard line and say, hey, well, we may cancel the season, and the players come up and they're ripping the protocols and stuff like that on a tweet fest. But ultimately, both sides want to get something done.
Yeah, and I think giving these guys who are undrafted players some look in camp is better than nothing at all. You don't want to see these guys get cut blindly because, well, it's simply not fair. I mean, in any other season, they would have had a full preseason in order to make their case, in order to get a spot on the roster, and then, you know, just this pandemic hits, and all of a sudden their shot at an NFL future or just making it in the league is kind of thrown out the window. It's such an unfortunate happenstance, and luckily they're going to hopefully get this 3-week window in order to impress, in order to make a roster here, because without it, I mean, that would just be a real heartbreak to see some of these guys who, you know, guys like Anthony Gordon, undrafted player Chris Miller, the safety who Brady Henderson was talking about, how he expects him to make his initial 53-man roster here. Who knows how these players could end up going without that 3-week window as to what kind of players they are.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, of course, the other things they have to work on is economics. And the big one is, how do you handle the losses from this season if there's no fans in the stands? And how do you try to handle the fact that there's no force majeure, which is the fact that if you have to cancel the season after the first week, you know, the players that have guarantees in their contracts keep the guarantees, and those that just have base salary guarantees, that doesn't have base salaries, they're guaranteed for the rest of the year, which would be a big loss for the owners. But I would imagine that they can get around that. And certainly for the losses, which I estimate, you know, be about $40 million of cap room, all you need to do on that one is, you know, because first the owners come up and they say, hey, we want a 35% of your salary in escrow. And they basically said, hey, pound rocks on that one. And then they came back and they were talking about all these different principles and all that. They wanted to take it over a 2-year period, but if you take it over a 2-year period with the flat cap, then what happens is that it's going to lower salaries, and that's what the players don't want. With particularly with the big jump that's going to come up in 2022 with the TV contract, simple thing. If it's $40 million, you take a flat cap next year, then you come back and you take $10 million a year for 4 years from 2022 to 2025. And, of course, you know, you go with the 17-game schedule. That would push up some of the losses that I think, you know, you can maybe get through it in 3 years. But again, I think you need 4 years. Players want a 10 or 11 years. That's going to be a little bit too long. So I think you want to get that off the books as fast as possible.
Yeah. Also, John, in the NFL, Jamal Adams ripping Adam Gase last night in the New York Daily News, calling him not the right leader for the Jets, and basically saying he doesn't really, you know, put himself out there for the organization. He has assistant coaches kind of handle all the messy work and all the adjustments and whatnot. I mean, obviously, Adam Gase hasn't won many people over in New York, and I don't know if there's any New York Jets out there that would be willing to go to bat for Adam Gase here, but who do you think lasts longer with the Jets organization, Jamal Adams or Adam Gase?
Right now, the way he's playing it, I think Jamal's going to be the one that goes first, and then Adam goes after the season, because he's really pushing the issue. He's pushing as hard as Jalen Ramsey. Now, some of the criticism is a little unfair because, you know, it's like, okay, Jamal, do you realize that Adam Gase is kind of a Mike Martz offensive guy? He's not going to be talking to the defense that much. I mean, he's got Greg Williams there to talk to the defense. And so it's like, what are you really saying, you know, as far as that goes? But, you know, there's always leadership questions about Adam. But again, he's an offensive guy. And so he's not going to be working as much with the defense. And the criticism of not getting up and saying things at halftime is why, I mean, he's in there with Sam Darnold and the offensive guys trying to adjust the game plan. And so at that 12-minute period, he doesn't have the time to address the team. And so he's going to have other coaches do it. So it's like, that's delegating responsibility, not being irresponsible.
Well, and Greg Williams is probably getting interviews from other coaches. He doesn't have enough, or from other teams, he doesn't have enough time to coach
exactly.
His own team.
Oh, no question about that, because I mean he's been offered so many jobs that as he said,
yeah, he doesn't know what to do with all these job offers.
Exactly. It's like very strange. So it's like I don't know how that one's going to go. But overall, hey, we're seeing a lot of different stuff happening. And, of course, we'll keep you up to date, particularly how that conference call is going with the owners and what might be resolved or what might not be resolved or what has been resolved. Hey, be sure to check out the Professor's Notes on 710sports.com. The Professor's Notes are brought to you by Infinity of Tacoma at 5. Coming up next, baseball starts tonight for the Mariners, 6-10 against Houston. Larry Stone talks about the excitement of baseball returning. It's the John Clayton Show, 710 ESPN Seattle.